Blog Talk Radio.
Skyrocketing healthcare and insurance costs. Extremely modest gains against chronic disease. Thousands die yearly due to drug reactions. What can be done? Thomas Edison is quoted as declaring, "The doctor of the future will give no medicine, but interest his patients in diet and nutrition, exercise, in the care of the human frame. He will teach them about the cause of all disease." The doctors of the future are here. Welcome to Phase 3 Wellness with your host, Keith Henry, ND, one of the doctors of the future.
Good afternoon, or good evening, rather, 7 p.m. Thank you for joining me. I am your host, Dr. Keith Henry, right here on Phase 3 Wellness on another beautiful Sunday afternoon / evening here in the Orlando, Florida area. Again, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining me at this prime time slot for Phase 3 Wellness. We have a very interesting and enlightening show for you today. We have quite a bit of information to get through, some news articles as we normally do. We're going to start off in our first segment, the Week in Natural News Review, and then we'll move on to the healing foods. We'll talk a little bit about strawberry today and how a new study come out to show how strawberry can be helpful in healing gastritis. And then lastly, we'll end up with the final segment, which is the healing herb, healing supplement segment, where we'll continue our discussion on the herbs that we were talking about last week, very, very beneficial herbs. Again, I'd like to welcome you, a special welcome to my friends over in Costa Rica once again. I'd like to also welcome my friends right here in the U.S. and Canada, and wherever you may be listening to Phase 3 Wellness. Again, I am your host, Dr. Keith Henry. I'm a naturopathic doctor, and I address healing from a Christian perspective. For, as I've said on here before, so-called alternative methods will have a holistic medicine, will always have a spiritual element, because we seek to heal the whole man, the spiritual, the physical, the emotional / mental, all of it. And therefore it's called holistic medicine, and I choose to deal with the spiritual man from a Christian perspective. Again, we have an exciting show for you today. I'd like to remind you to visit me over on Facebook, facebook.com/naturedoc. You can also listen here every week, and we have a Twitter page. We have to change that around some, though. And as the ads that we run on here, you can listen to the ads that we run to listen to find out where you would like to go, or where you can go, rather, to visit for more information. Again, we're going to take a quick break, and as we come back, we're going to get started immediately with our first segment, the Week in Natural News Review. Just a reminder, we also have the blog up. Before we take this break, we have the blog up. If you're visiting or listening online, you can go to the blog, or rather the chat room, rather, and if you don't want to call in with a question or a comment, you can just shoot us a chat, a question in the chat room, and we'll do our best to answer either through the chat room or right here on the air. Again, I am your host, Dr. Keith Henry. We'll be back in just a moment.
How do you feel? No, really. How do you feel? Do you feel lively? Are you bursting with energy? Or do you feel run down and suffer from a lack of energy most of the time? Have frequent colds, aches, and pains of one sort or another? The fact of the matter is that most people in America are not well. But you can begin to change all of that today by simply visiting the Simple Natural Health Secrets blog of Keith Henry, ND, at www.phase3ministries.com/WordPress. Go there now and explore the wealth of amazing wellness information. That's www.phase3ministries.com/WordPress, the Simple Natural Health Secrets blog.
You're listening to Phase 3 Wellness with Dr. Keith Henry. Be sure to listen right here every week at the same time. You can also visit Dr. Henry on Facebook at facebook.com/naturedoc. Thanks for listening, and here's to your health.
Do you know anyone that has health issues? Of course you do. Have you noticed the rise in popularity of natural therapies and alternative medicine? Sure you have. Have you ever wondered if alternative therapies work, or if it's just all quackery? Then you need to visit the Simple Natural Health Secrets blog at phase3ministries.com/WordPress. Keith Henry, ND, is trained in natural naturopathy and provides amazing insight at the Simple Natural Health Secrets blog that he has gained from years of hands-on experience. Check it out after this show at phase3ministries.com/WordPress.
Hi, and welcome back to Phase 3 Wellness. Thank you for joining me this evening. I'm your host, Dr. Keith Henry. We're going to get right into our program now. We'll start off with the Week in Natural News Review. And this is a segment, if it's your first time listening, where I take articles that have come out during the week and discuss and analyze these articles, articles that deal directly or indirectly with natural medicine or health in general, mainly natural medicine or alternative medicine. The first article I'm going to discuss here is more of an informational article, and it was taken from news.yahoo.com, and it was published on the 29th, which was yesterday, and it was entitled "Millions Could Go Off Blood Pressure Meds," and the article talks about the changes of what is considered normal blood pressure. It starts off by saying that 1 in 4 American adults over the age of 60 are being treated for high blood pressure, and these could go off of their medication under recent guidelines issued in the United States. And they cited a study that was produced on yesterday. The article points out further that the changes which stirred controversy in the medical community could mean nearly 6 million people may no longer need drugs to control their blood pressure. It says that Duke University researchers said in the Journal of the American Medical Association that the findings are the first to analyze the impact of 2014 guidelines that raised blood pressure targets to 150 over 90 instead of the previous goal of 140 over 90 in adults age 60 and older. And then they cite the lead author of the study, Anne Marie Navon-Boggan, a cardiology fellow at the Duke University School of Medicine. She's quoted as saying, quote, "Raising the target in older adults is controversial, and not all experts agree with this new recommendation." She said, in this study, we wanted to determine the number of adults affected by these changes. She goes on to say further that the guidelines were issued by the Joint National Committee on Prevention, Detection, Evaluation, and Treatment of High Blood Pressure. The article goes on to say further, analyzing 2005 to 2010 data on 16,000 people in the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, which was conducted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Duke researchers found the proportion of U.S. adults considered eligible for hypertension treatment would dip from 40.6% under the old guidelines to 31.7% under the new ones. In addition, the article says 13.5 million adults, most of them over the age of 60, would no longer be considered in a danger zone. It says further that of that group, 5.8 million adults would no longer need blood pressure pills. The new guidelines do not address whether these adults should still be considered as having hypertension, she said, but they would no longer need medication to lower their blood pressure. So here's the thing. If you look at people who typically have high blood pressure and you look at the or what's considered high blood pressure, and you look at the diseases that they most frequently die from, you can determine a good blood pressure or a normal blood pressure or a healthy blood pressure. People who typically have 120 over 80 or below, 120 over 80 is the norm right now, considered normal. But you have people who tend to be athletes and even some vegetarians, vegans, would sometimes have blood pressure at even lower, 116 over 65 or over 70, and have no issues. And so, but the norm is 120 over 80. And so they're saying that once you get over the age of 60, they're saying that they're going to allow it to be 150 over 90 as opposed to 140 over 90. Now, I'm not opposed to them, you know, personally lowering it. The thing is, are you going to, if you're going to stop the medication, are you going to educate these people on how to eat and how to live so as to bring the blood pressure down considerably. You know, the thing is, the idea is that, well, when we get older, our blood pressure automatically goes up. Well, maybe so if you grow older eating unhealthily and living an unhealthy lifestyle, but that's not necessarily the case. Notwithstanding, I think it's a good idea that people are not, or that many, many people are being taken off of this blood pressure medication to the extent that I've talked about on here before, how there are other ways, more healthy ways to lower blood pressure. There's lifestyle, there's diet, there's herbs and supplements to help do the exact same thing without all of the side effects of taking of things that can happen when taking blood pressure medication long term. Not the least, is kidney damage. And so again, that was just an article that was published on yesterday entitled "Millions Go Off Blood Pressure Meds." So what we'll do now is we will move on to our next article. And I talked a little bit about this topic not long ago, maybe a couple of weeks back, about some of the dangers that's being found in hospitals. And mainly the point I'm trying to make is that sometimes, yes, it's a necessity to have to go to the hospital, mainly in times of emergencies or surgeries, just surgeries that are necessary. Many surgeries are not necessary. Of course, if you're in a car accident and you have sustained trauma, of course you need to go to the emergency room in the hospital. But that does not lessen or eradicate the fact that many people leave the hospital who went in for simple surgeries or something simple, and they never come out, or they come out in a body bag as a result of acquiring superbug hospital infections. And this is what this next article deals with, and it's from naturalnews.com, and written by Mike Adams, who's the editor there, and he's entitled this article, "Has a Plague Already Arrived? 205 Americans Die Each Day After Acquiring Superbug Hospital Infections." So let's think about that for a minute. If 205 people, 205 Americans, that's not considering any other countries, just 205 Americans, he says, die every day in American hospitals from superbug hospital infections. So if they have 365 days in a normal year and 205 people die every day, that would be about, 74,000, almost 75,000 people a year that die from hospital infections, infection rather than they acquired while at the hospital. And I talked about this a little bit a few weeks back, but he kind of adds more to his article. He says, listen, if a jumbo jet crashed into the ocean every single day, it would roughly equal the number of Americans who die each day following superbug infections acquired at U.S. hospitals. He says, far from being some hyped-up scare story, that's actually the conclusion of none other than the CDC, which has now publicly warned that 1 in 25 hospital patients gets infected and tens of thousands die each year. He says, on any given day, 1 in 25 hospital patients has at least one, actually he's quoting from the CDC newsroom. Quote, he says, on any given day, 1 in 25 hospital patients have at least one healthcare-associated infection, reports the CDC newsroom. He says, the CDC's 2011 survey of 183 hospitals shows that an estimated 648,000 patients nationwide suffered 721,000 infections and 75,000 of them died. And this was reported in the Washington Post. So he says, if you do the math, that comes out to 205 deaths per day on average in U.S. hospitals. He goes on to say further, keep in mind that if terrorists were killing 205 Americans per day, every news network in the country would cover the story 24/7. If airplane crashes were killing 205 Americans per day, it would be headline news everywhere. And if vitamins were killing even just one person a day, the entire government would be calling to ban all vitamins. This is so true. But when hospital superbug infections result in the deaths of 205 Americans per day, it is simply another statistic and not treated as a national emergency. He says somehow the annual death of 75,000 Americans is considered business as usual in a sick care system that virtually everyone considers a disastrous failure. And again, as I've said on here before, this is one of the reasons why a bill like what we would call the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare was able to pass. Now, let me hasten to say that, to be fair to this Obamacare bill, when people are asked in these studies or in these polls about Obamacare as a whole, about the Affordable Care Act, most people hate it. But when they're polled about, and they're not told about Obamacare per se, but they're polled on the elements of it, it's very, very popular. So let me say it this way: when they ask people, listen, what's your opinion of Obamacare? Oh, I hate it, the majority. But when they come back and they say, okay, what's your opinion on the insurance companies having to cover pre-existing conditions? They like it. What's your opinion on everybody being able to be covered? Or they like it. So basically, that's to be fair to the bill as a whole. Nevertheless, the idea that people are being forced to take insurance is not a very popular idea. And again, just to be fair to this, the basic idea of Obamacare in terms of forcing everyone to be on insurance was originally not a Democratic idea. It was originally a Republican idea. And again, just for the record, I'm neither a Republican or a Democrat, so I regard myself as an independent. So I'm not either for or against either any particular party, but for or against anything that would benefit the country as a whole. And as a whole, I don't think many of the provisions of Obamacare are good. Some of the provisions are good, but the majority of them are not. And the idea of forcing people to be on it is not a good idea in my humble opinion. Nevertheless, it is what it is. It is the law now. And one of the point I'm trying to make is that the reason that they were able to pass such what has now become a very unpopular law as a whole is because the healthcare system was so dismal, and the cost was just astronomical. And as I talked about last week, listen to that show, it would be a good idea that you listen to that show. I pointed out in detail how when you look at the numbers, we don't even have the number one healthcare system in the world. We're ranked at like number 13, 12 or 13. But yet we have the most expensive healthcare in the world. That's not good. And if the pharmaceutical company's grip and the insurance company's grip and the medical companies or industries' grips were not so so monopolistic, and there was more freedom, if you will, for people to choose the type of providers that they would like to go to, the way was opened up for natural health providers to have more leeway in what they could do, you would see an increase in the quality of healthcare, and also you would see a decrease in the cost. That said, he goes on to say further on in this article, Mike Adams goes on to point out how he says what these numbers prove is that a hospital is a very dangerous place. Simply entering the hospital for a seemingly routine surgical procedure can result in your death. He goes on to say that he personally knows of many people who have entered the hospital to undergo elective non-emergency surgery and then never came out alive. And he says, Father, who is the most likely to infect you in a hospital? He says, of course, your doctor. He said, the very people who claim to be state licensed authorities on all things related to health are actually carriers of deadly disease who routinely and inadvertently infect new patients with extremely dangerous microbes. They don't do this on purpose, he says, of course, but neither do they take the precautions necessary to prevent it. Hand-washing practices, he says, for example, are routinely ignored by most medical staff. He says that there was a study commissioned by the licensing body for U.S. hospitals, and they found that poor sanitation practices by hospital staff kills 247 patients each day across America. He goes on to say further that the study found that doctors and nurses wash their hands only 30 to 70% of the time that they enter or exit a patient's room. So here we have something as simple as hand washing and some of the other precautions that need to be taken. Now, I've always been of the opinion that because it's the states that license and other healthcare professionals, therefore the state is also taking partial responsibility. So when people begin to sue these doctors and these hospitals for these things, because they have been recognized and licensed by the state, it seems fair to me, it seems just to me that the state should also be liable. Because if the state is going to say, okay, we're going to recognize this profession only, and we're not going to license this profession, or we're not going to recognize it, we're not going to let other people practice, or whatever the case might be, but these are the ones that we're going to recognize by a state license. When that person is found culpable, or that hospital is found culpable in a court of law, and they have to pay out money or whatever the case may be, then the state that licensed them, that gave them this monopolistic practice, should also, in my estimation, be held accountable to some degree. Because what they're saying is, okay, you have the awesome power of the state to back you, and we're going to, and be, once you become licensed here, no other health, no other type of practitioner can practice in this state without them having a license, or whatever the case might be, or we're not going to allow them to get licensed, we're not going to license them in this state, or whatever the case may be. And so if the state is going to take that position, then they also should take responsibility when things happen that they've thrown their power and recognition behind. He goes on to say, Adams goes on to say in this article, that he says, by definition, superbugs are completely resistant to modern antibiotic drugs. He says, all of Big Pharma's chemicals are useless against them, and because conventional medicine completely disregards the antibacterial power of colloidal silver, copper, garlic, or antibacterial herbs, patients are never given those treatment options. As a result, he says, a superbug infection almost always means death when you're in the hospital. He said, this is a case where the ignorance of conventional medicine can literally get you killed. He said, further, as it turns out, doctors and hospitals have no clue how to stop superbug infections, so they leave patients to die, and they die by the hundreds each day, over 200 daily in the United States alone. He said, the CDC isn't even trying to hide the statistics. They're claiming, in fact, he said, that they are making progress on this front, when the truth is they have already lost the war. He goes on to further point out some of the failures of antibiotics. He said the great failure of modern medicine is that it invented and unleashed the vehicle of our own medical self-destruction, antibiotics. He says these patented chemicals were once heralded as miraculous cures, but have now thrust humanity to the brink of medical self-destruction. Soon, a simple infection entering your body from a minor scrape or cut may prove deadly, with doctors having run out of prescription chemicals to use against it. And then every routine surgery would be a life and death matter. He says this includes cosmetic surgery, gallbladder removal surgery, and, of course, emergency room trauma surgery. And then he cites an article that he wrote in September 2013 saying, quote, the coming plague will not be stopped by drugs. CDC now admits the era of antibiotics at an end as bacteria outwit drug companies. The whole approach of fighting bugs with isolated chemicals was doomed to fail from the start, of course, since Mother Nature adapts to chemical threats far more quickly than drug companies can roll out new chemicals. He says, sadly, the very approach of using an isolated chemical to combat disease is rooted in a 1950s mentality that has nearly reached its endpoint in the history of medicine. He says, the CDC all but admits this now, saying the era of antibiotics is nearing its end. And then he says, quote, if we are not careful, we will soon be in a post-antibiotic era. Dr. Tom Friedman, director of the CDC. Finally, he closes out his article by saying, every day, 205 Americans die from the effect, or after effects, rather, of antibiotics. He says, sure, antibiotics save a lot of lives in the short term, but how many lives will they kill in the long run? Because sooner or later, a superbug plague may emerge that burns through the population. And so I would highly recommend, if you're listening to this show, that you become very familiar with some of the herbal antibiotics, also some of the supplements that he mentioned, like colloidal silver, copper, garlic, and some of the other antibacterial herbs that I've been talking about the past couple of weeks in the herb supplement segment of the program. if you remember, if you go back and listen to the show week before, the show last week and week before, you can pull up the archive, and you can listen, and you can burn it to a CD, listen to it in your car, whatever. Pass it around to your friends and family, but understand that it is true. These superbugs, there's nothing they can do for them with antibiotics, with chemical antibiotics. So you need to look at some of God's antibiotics. And this is one of the reasons why you should become very familiar and educate yourself with respect to healing overall. I am your host, Dr. Keith Henry. You are listening to Phase 3 Wellness. We are in the first segment of our show, the Weekend Natural News Review. At this point, we are going to go ahead and go over to one of the main articles that we're talking about today, which was in the show headline, in the title headline for this show. And this article is going to come from Dr. Mercola. And we're going to be talking a little bit about that earwax that we have, that some people like and some people don't like, but it has a purpose. There's nothing that the Creator has built into our bodies that does not have a purpose. It's a matter of what purpose it's used for. So let me go over here to Dr. Mercola's site here, and we're going to pull up this article, and we're going to talk about it. You know, I'd like to remind you that if you would like to call in, I didn't do this at the beginning of the show. I apologize. If you'd like to call in, you can do so with a question or a comment at 917-889-2207. That's 917-889-2207. Again, also, I'd like to remind you that we have the chat room up. And if you would like, you can send the chat, have a question or comment, you can put a chat in there as well. Or you can put it in the chat room as well. Now let's move on to this article. And it's entitled Secretion Secrets, Things You Didn't Know About Earwax. And this was published on yesterday, March 29, 2014, by Dr. Mercola. And in it, Dr. Mercola is explaining some of the benefits and how about earwax and what it's called and how it works and why we have it, etc. And he, as he points out earlier in his article, that earwax is technically known as cerumen, C-E-R-U-M-E-N, and it is actually produced by glands that are contained in your ear canal. And he points out how it's made up of mostly dead skin cells, but earwax also contains other substances, including lysozyme, which is actually an antibacterial enzyme. It also contains fatty acids, alcohol, cholesterol, etc. And then he goes on to point out how, in fact, earwax isn't wax at all. It's actually a mixture of water-soluble secretions. And he says, and although you probably don't give your earwax much thought, it actually represents one of your body's most ingenious protective mechanisms. He points out further that earwax isn't simply a hygienic nuisance. It's actually far from being a hygienic nuisance. And he goes on to point out how our ears produce earwax constantly so that ideally you maintain just the right amount in your ear canal. He says, unless you have some type of an earwax blockage, which he's going to discuss, we'll discuss later on in this article, as he points out. He says, unless you have some type of an earwax blockage, it's best to just leave your earwax alone. He says, don't try to remove it with the cotton swabs or other devices. He says, in fact, if you have too little earwax in your ear canal, your ears may feel dry and itchy. He says, this is because earwax is there for a reason, and the reason is to protect your ears and provide lubrication. And then he goes on to say it does this by the following ways. Number one, by preventing dust, bacteria, and other germs from entering and damaging your ear. Number two, this earwax also traps dirt, and it actually also slows the growth of bacteria. Number three, it's protecting the skin of your ear canal from becoming irritated by water. And so again, as I told you before, the Creator, those of you who are familiar with the Bible, David says, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And this is one of the reasons why you really need to be very careful if you go to the doctor and your doctor recommends surgery of a particular organ. They'll say, we're going to take off your tonsils because you don't really need them. We're going to take out your gallbladder. We're going to take out your appendix because you don't really need it. Now, if you have a problem like an inflamed gallbladder, that could be a cause for concern. It may need surgery. If it's inflamed and there's inflammation and it's about to burst. But generally speaking, this idea that if there's not a problem or you may have some problem, you don't really need it anyway, we're going to cut it out. If you didn't need it, it wouldn't be there. The Creator did not make a mistake by giving us tonsils and gallbladders and some of these other things that are being cut out unnecessarily. And so just remember, if it's just not a necessity to have it cut out, then you need to leave it in. Marcola Galona said further on in this article, says your ears are self-cleaning, and earwax is actually the self-cleaning agent. And then he points out, he cites the American Academy of Otolaryngology, which is the Head and Neck Surgery Foundation. He says, under ideal circumstances, your ear canal should never have to be clean. He says excess earwax should move out of your ear canal automatically as cells there actually migrate naturally, he says. The removal of earwax is also helped along by movements of your jaw or when you're talking or chewing, etc. And once it reaches your outer ear, it will simply fall out or be removed when you shower or bathe. And then he cites them. He cites the AAOHNSF, again, which is Head and Neck Surgery Foundation. He says, quote, unfortunately, many people mistakenly believe that earwax should be routinely removed for personal hygiene. This is not so. In fact, attempting to remove earwax with cotton tip swabs, bobby pins, or other probing devices can actually result in damage to the ear, including trauma, impaction of the earwax, or even temporary deafness. These objects only push the wax in deeper and can block the ear canal entirely, end quote. So again, he was quoting the Head and Neck Surgery Foundation, AAOHNSF. He goes on to say further, there are two types of earwax, and we're going to talk about those two types briefly here. First type is that which is wet, which is sticky and yellow or brown in color. The second type is that which is dry, is crumbly and lighter color, and it could be gray or tan. So the single gene has been identified, he says, as a determining factor in which type of earwax you have, and your family background does matter. He goes on to say that dry earwax is common in East Asian populations, while wet earwax dominates in African and European populations. So again, if you are African or of African descent, African American, etc., or European, or of European ancestry, you're more likely to have earwax, not automatically, but more likely to have earwax which is sticky, wet, yellow, or brown in color, whereas if you are more of an Asian ancestry, your earwax would tend to be more dry, crumbly and lighter color, or gray or tan. He goes on to point out how the same gene variant leads to dry earwax is responsible for reduced underarm body odor in Chinese, Japanese, and Korean individuals. So interestingly, he says, when measuring the concentration of 12 volatile organic compounds in earwax from East Asian and white men, Caucasian earwax had more odorous compounds which one day might be used to help detect disease, he says. That's interesting. Something as lowly, I guess you could say, as earwax has a lot to say about us. He goes on to say further, like certain other bodily secretions, earwax may be an indicator of your exposure to environmental pollutants, because although there's not much reason to measure earwax pollutants as opposed to, say, getting a blood test. He says further, to get an idea of how much you could theoretically learn from analyzing earwax, consider an analysis of earwax from a blue whale. He says, as BBC News reported, blue whales actually retain their earwax for life, and then recording life events similar to the way tree rings reveal arid and wet seasons during its lifetime. He says, and he was citing a BBC News report, and he's still referring to this BBC News report talking about how the whales carries their earwax for life. He says the whale earwax has been described as a time capsule for stress and toxins, which one analysis showing the whale had been exposed to several organic pollutants, including pesticides and flame-retardant chemicals, as well as mercury, and had higher levels of the stress hormone cortisol released upon reaching the age of sexual maturity. So it's interesting. That's just a side that he points out there. He goes on to say further in this article that earwax, about when the times when you should remove earwax. He says, Dr. Mercola says, I have treated hundreds of people in my life who had cerumen impactions. That means earwax impactions in layman's terms. Typically, this required flushing the ear with a syringe or using a dental irrigator to soften the earwax so it could come out. He says the wax can effectively eliminate most of the sound coming to that ear, making one nearly deaf on one side. He says it's estimated that more than 12 million people a year suffer from impacted earwax. He goes on to say, he says, the accumulation of earwax may cause your ear canal to become blocked, leading to the following symptoms. Number one, earache, fullness in the ear, or a sensation that the ear is plugged. Number two, partial reversible hearing loss, which may be progressive. Number three, tinnitus, ringing or noises in the ear. Number four, itching, odor or discharge, and coughing. He says if you experience a buildup of wax, you can easily remedy the situation at home by using either water or oil or eardrop to soften the wax to help it migrate on its own. Or you can use ear irrigation to flush the wax out. He says acceptable liquids that you can use for this purpose include number one, coconut oil, number two, hydrogen peroxide, 3% available in most grocery stores, number four, carbamide peroxide, and number five, olive oil. He says further that it's worth noting that using plain sterile water or a sterile saline solution to soften earwax works just as well as over-the-counter eardrops. He says, however, I normally find that high-pressure irrigation of the ear canal with a syringe is necessary to remove troublesome wax. He said, this should only be done by a professional as if done improperly, it can actually damage your eardrum. He says, additionally, you should not irrigate your ears if you have diabetes, a perforated eardrum, a tube in your eardrum, or if your immune system is weakened. He says, if you suffer from a serious impactation, or you can't get results at home, you may need to get the earwax remedy removed by a physician who can manually remove the wax using microsuction, et cetera. And he points out that prevention is the best way to treat this problem. I agree wholeheartedly. He says frequent excess buildup of earwax can oftentimes be traced back to an omega-3 deficiency, so the remedy is quite simple. Take your high-quality he says an animal-based omega-3 supplement. I would say a vegan, one rooted in a vegan, like flaxseed, something like that, to help with your omega-3 levels. He says once you've cleared out an excess buildup of impaction, making sure you're getting sufficient amounts of omega-3 will normally prevent a recurrence. If the earwax buildup does return, it's a clue that you may still have a serious omega-3 deficiency. So, again, that is... interesting article by Dr. Mercola. It can be found at Mercola.com. And you are listening to Phase 3 Wellness. I am your host, Dr. Keith Henry. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We have to go over to our next article. We're going to deal with one more article before we go over to our healing food segment. But we're going to take a quick break. I'll be back in just a moment, and we'll continue the show. You're listening to Phase 3 Wellness.
Do you know anyone that has health issues? Of course you do. Have you noticed the rise in popularity of natural therapies and alternative medicine? Sure you have. Have you ever wondered if alternative therapies work or if it's just all quackery? Then you need to visit the Simple Natural Health Secrets blog at phase3ministries.com/WordPress. Keith Henry, ND, is trained in natural naturopathy and provides amazing insight at the Simple Natural Health Secrets blog that he has gained from years of hands-on experience. Check it out after this show at phase3ministries.com/WordPress.
You're listening to Phase 3 Wellness with Dr. Keith Henry. Be sure to listen right here every week at the same time. You can also visit Dr. Henry on Facebook at facebook.com/naturedoc. Thanks for listening, and here's to your health.
Hi, and welcome back to Phase 3 Wellness. Thank you for joining me this Sunday evening. I am your host, Dr. Keith Henry. We are about to pivot over into our healing food section. We're only going to be talking about one healing food today, which is going to be strawberry, and we're going to be talking about it in connection with its benefit, recent benefit, recent article that came out talking about its benefit from gastritis. Before we go there, we have one last article left in our first segment, the Week in Natural News Review. This is also from naturalnews.com, and it was published on yesterday as well. It's entitled, Much Touted CDC Study Claiming Obesity Has Plummeted in Preschool Is Found to Be Junk Science Propaganda. I know I saw the story that apparently now that childhood obesity has dropped, and there was a lot of fanfare about it, and I thought, wow, is that really true? Could that really be true? And then I see this article here, because it doesn't seem to me that our dietary practices and lifestyle practices have changed all that much in this country. So he goes on to start off by saying, he says, who can trust the American Medical Association and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, two institutions engaged in suppressing self-empowered natural healing? The author goes on to say, further, these institutions, and by the way, the author is L.J. Devon, he's a staff writer for NatureNews.com. He says, these institutions work by misinforming the public through their vast media influence and control. He says, there's no surprise that a new claim projected by the CDC and promoted by the AMA is merely just political propaganda based on junk science. He says, the report published in late February in the Journal of the American Medical Association brings forth findings from the CDC which say that obesity in American preschoolers has fallen 43% in the past decade. He says further that the First Lady was quick to promote the findings, reveling in the federal government's success at fighting the national obesity epidemic in recent years through federal nutrition initiatives. And he talks about how big government enthusiasts touted programs that bring more physical activity to child care programs, including federal nutrition programs for low-income women and children, WIC. He says as this government story hit the headlines, skeptical researchers dug in deeper, and in doing so, they found no supporting evidence for the study, he says. He says, when obesity specialists and researchers looked into the data, they found out that the 43% drop in preschooler obesity was indeed too good to be true. After comparing the highly broadcast study with similar studies that involved more participants, the researchers found no statistical correlation that even came close. He says, upon further investigation into state WIC assessments, the researchers actually found data that suggested a continual trend of rising obesity in preschoolers instead of a 43% decline. And then he quotes Dr. Lee Kaplan, who is the director of the Weight Center at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, saying, quote, you need to have a healthy degree of skepticism about the validity of this finding. He says, Dr. Lee went on to say that there is no supporting evidence suggesting that changes in childhood behavior could have made such a major 43% shift in less than 8 years. And the author of the article says, well, a 2013 study on the federal WIC program, which included 200,000 children, found virtually no change in obesity rates in preschoolers. Now, that was just in 2013. He says, further, California's Los Angeles County WIC program actually correlated with higher obesity rates in 3- and 4-year-olds. And the CDC's morbidity and mortality weekly report even recognized this in 2013, showing the obesity rate rise from 17% to 20.4%. So he says the CDC's misleading fluke study, he says, included data from only 871 children between the ages of 2 and 5 in 2011 and 2012. So the skeptical researchers first pointed out that the CDC goes by a vague chart when determining obesity based on a child's age and gender-specific growth. He says, in contrast, adult obesity is measured more comprehensively by body mass index, a ratio of weight to height. He says, furthermore, the skeptical researchers showed how easy it was for errors to creep into a small sample of only 871 children. He says, the data set, which was selected from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, could theoretically be picked through and tailored to fit a researcher's bias, his agenda or her agenda, or special interest. Basically, the article says, it could have been very easy by random chance for errors to creep into the study when such a small sample of children were studied. Then he cites epidemiologist Jeffrey Kabat, of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City, where he says, quote, in small samples like this, you are going to have chance fluctuations. Finally, the author says, furthermore, the CDC study rounded the percentages in the study. He said the reported 43% drop in obesity comes from a 13.9% rate in 2003 and 2004, which was rounded to 14%. That decreased to an 8.4% rate in 2011 and 2012, which was rounded down to 8%. An obvious manipulation of the data. Again, he says, how can these institutions be trusted? Finally, he says, the CDC projected data also recognizes a margin of error for the 2003 data that could be up to 6.8%, too low, and a margin of error for the 2011 data that could be up to 5.7%, too high. These variables imply that the obesity rate could actually have statistically increased. He says, sadly, incompetence working for the Journal of the American Medical Association published an imprecise CDC study promoting a misleading falsehood. Again, as you can see, as we've talked about on here before, people with money and with a desire to control certain industries, and it's not just the health industry, but many different industries, they have no interest, many of them, in promoting fair and unbiased information, and especially if they have people that they need to pay. Shareholders. So just remember, when you're hearing these things, try to understand it from all angles. Try to understand as who the study is coming from. Compare it with other studies that have been done. Compare it with your common sense and with your own research and findings. You can't depend on someone else to look after your health for you. You are responsible for looking after your own health. Yes, doctors and et cetera can help, but ultimately you suffer when you're sick. And so ultimately you need to make your own decisions, decide which way you want to go, when you want to use natural medicine, when you want to use allopathic medicine, you know, whatever you want to do. You just need to make sure that you are taking it into your own hands, your own health, because it is your responsibility. Now we're going to pivot over to our week, our natural foods, our healing foods, rather. And as I said before we went to break, our healing food for this week, we're just going to deal with one, and that's going to be strawberry. And we're going to deal with it in a limited fashion. We're not going to go into a lot of detail for this strawberry as we normally do, because we'll deal with strawberry on a whole other topic. We'll take it and we'll deal with it for maybe 5 or 10 minutes at another time, talking about some of the benefits of it. But I just wanted to talk about it as a healing food in context of some new research that had come out showing how it may be beneficial in helping gastritis. And basically, there are some European researchers that have uncovered that strawberries have a powerful ability to actually combat gastritis. And they actually, in their study that they did, one of the researchers by the name of Sarah Tulipani wrote, quote, the positive effects of strawberries are not only linked to their antioxidant capacity and high content of phenolic compounds, but also to the fact that they activate the antioxidant defenses and enzymes of the body. Their studies, end quote, their studies actually show that ingesting strawberries led to a reduction in the appearance of stomach ulcerations post-ethanol consumption. Bottom line, essentially in layman's term, the right strawberries, the right fruit contains substances that can actually help prevent the start of inflammation at the cellular level. And remember, we've talked about the problems with inflammation here on this show before. Inflammation is the start or the root of many, many diseases, including cancer and some of the other diseases that we have, some of these chronic diseases. So you have to put out the fire, and that inflammation, it can do great, great damage. And so when you hear that strawberries have the capacity to actually lower inflammation at the cellular level, remember, you live or die on the cellular level. Remember that. You're only as healthy as your cells are. And so what inflammation does is it creates an internal environment or internal terrain that sets your body up for all kinds of diseases. And so in this context, we are hearing that strawberry contains substances that can actually help prevent the start of inflammation at the cellular level. And this actually, in finding this out and coming to this conclusion, the strawberries are among the most important fruits to fight inflammation. In their mind, it also paved the way for others to look deeper into new stomach inflammatory diseases and also related treatment options. For instance, the Mayo Clinic advises people with gastritis to eat a diet that consists of low-acid fruits and to avoid spicy and fatty foods. And, of course, strawberries make the list of low-acid fruits, as do pears, raspberries, and apples. It's also advised by some of the other so-called experts to try and minimize stress levels, of course. If you're stressing out, you're gonna cause an inflammatory internal inflammatory response in the body, and it's going to help contribute to any inflammation, even cause inflammation at the cellular level. Other recommendations coming from the so-called experts are reduce alcohol consumption and speak with the doctor. I would say eliminate alcohol consumption altogether. And as possible, get away from any medications that you may be taking. See if you can switch those out. Talk to your doctor, your physician about switching those out, about finding maybe some natural products or some natural lifestyle changes or a combination of the two that can help you accomplish the same thing you may be accomplishing with your medication, because with the medication you're not really accomplishing the underlying healing. You may be accomplishing subduing the symptoms, but you're not accomplishing any true healing. Finally, strawberries are actually good for reducing inflammation of not only your stomach, which would help with gastritis, but other kinds of inflammation as well, including in your joints. In fact, the Harvard School of Public Health conducted a study which showed that women who ate 16 or more strawberries per week, so that's what, 2 times 7 is 14, so even eating two strawberries every day, and then on the final day eating 3 or 4 strawberries, this study at Harvard School of Public Health, they were able to show that women who ate 16 or more strawberries weekly were less likely to have C-reactive protein, CRP, in the body, which is a telltale marker of inflammation, and which also, when you have that inflammation, especially if it's in your breast area or some of these other areas, this is how you end up with breast cancer. Finally, strawberries have also been shown to improve your eye health. They've been shown to suppress cancer cell growth and also to regulate blood pressure. And so, again, eat strawberries. And a lot of times, try and get organic ones, ones that are not loaded down with pesticides. I remember reading a report some years ago pointing out that strawberries were the most densely sprayed fruit imaginable. I don't know if that's still the case. So try to get, if you're getting them, try to get organic ones, and you will be able to, you will reap many of the benefits that we've been talking about here, especially if you're suffering from gastritis or inflammation of the bowel, any type of inflammation of the bowel. Strawberries may very well be something to add to a program to help reduce or eliminate that. Again, I am your host, Dr. Keith Henry. You are listening to Phase 3 Wellness. We are going to pivot over now into our final segment, which is our healing herb, healing supplement segment. And we've been talking about herbs here the past few weeks in this segment. And I mentioned last week when we closed out that I was going to talk about, in these last 6 or 7 minutes or so, I'll do so, an herb. And I'll probably add, because I don't have enough information to tell you about this herb in the amount of time that I have, but I'll go over into a little bit of the information. I talked last week about Oregon graperoot. I talked about olive leaf extract the week before that, and how especially olive leaf extract is a superb natural antibiotic, as we were talking about natural antibiotics earlier in the show. Now, this next herb that we're going to talk about here is Asha, O-S-H-A, Asha. And this herb is probably very few of you have even ever heard of. And it is other common names. Well, first let me back up and say it's actually in the parsley family. And so other common names of the herbs are Colorado cough root, life root, and there's a couple of others. At any rate, this herb, Asha, is also an antibacterial herb, and it's typically found in the American Great Plains and also in the Rocky Mountain area. And just to give you an idea, it is used for many, many type of issues, as are most herbs. But it is actually an antibacterial herb. So, you know, you have some herbs that are more antiviral. This herb is more antibacterial. And bacteria can cause some serious problems. Like, for instance, you can have viral pneumonia or bacterial pneumonia. And bacterial pneumonia can do you really some really, really bad, put you in some very bad places, if you will. But let's look at some of the evidence of the benefit of Asha. It's antibacterial, and not only that, it's also anti-inflammatory. It's ideal if you have viral infections for your sinuses, also your throat and your upper and lower respiratory systems. Asha can also help bring up respiratory secretions, and it relaxes smooth muscle and making it beneficial for your cough as well as if you have asthma as well. So it's similar in some ways, but probably not quite as powerful. But it works in some ways similar to lobelia. Lobelia is excellent for that as well. If you're an asthmatic or if you have breathing problems, lobelia is excellent to help your lungs to breathe better. Anyway, Asha also can helps bring up respiratory secretions, and it also helps to relax smooth muscles, making it beneficial for you for cough as well as for breathing difficulties for those who have asthma. Now, it induces sweating, and it can also help eliminate toxins through the pores of your skin. Anything that can help induce sweating, even sometimes in natural medicine, we will use a fever bath. It's a form of hydrotherapy to actually induce sweating or to induce an artificial fever in the body for the express purpose of boosting the immune system, the white blood cells particularly, and also for sweating to help sweat out toxins out of the body. So some of the specific health conditions that Asha can be used for are arthritis as well as carpal tunnel syndrome. It's actually one of traditional remedies in Native American medicine. And usually you'll read from herbal masters like Dr. John Christopher that, specifically speaking, if the American Indians used a herb, you could be sure that herb is one of the top herbs that you can use, because they had to depend on these herbs. So they became masters at knowing what worked and what didn't. And this is one of the herbs that they used. And even the early settlers, they also used it for long-term relief of inflammation of the body. Also, it can be beneficial in instances of bronchitis, cold, influenza, as well as sinusitis. And so, again, we'll finish that herb up next week. We would plan on doing that, and then we'll go on to our next herb or next substance there. Again, you have been listening to Phase 3 Wellness. I am your host, Dr. Keith Henry. I am about out of time. I'd like to remind you to join me next week at the same time, 7 p.m. If you didn't catch the beginning of the show, the replay will be available probably in about 5 to 7 minutes after the show ends, after the live broadcast ends. I'd like to remind you to go visit my blog or my Facebook page to read up on more information. If you need assistance or you need help, you can always contact my office. You can call us. Just go to phase3ministries.com. The phone number is there. Especially if you're in the Orlando area, if you set up an appointment, you can do so. Yeah, thank you for listening. Goodbye.